Anytime someone visits a new church, it can be a daunting thing. Two things are true. Anytime somebody comes to a church for the first time, number one, they are searching for God in some way, and number two, it is an awkward and scary proposition. So you can pretty much know that anytime somebody comes to a church, they're wanting God overcomes their awkwardness and fear. So keep that in mind while I tell you the story. A woman came to a church for the first time, and she was awkward and fearful, and so much so that she asked somebody by the back door, I really want to visit your church, but my wife is in the car, and I need to know before I bring her in if we would be welcome. Well, the person by the door said, well, we just teach the Bible here. In other words, no, you wouldn't be welcome. Well, in reality, what they were saying was, we don't really go right by the Bible here, because Jesus welcomed people, even people that were known as tax collectors and sinners. Those were the people that were most welcome in the presence of Jesus. It was the good church people that were uncomfortable around Jesus. So no, we don't go right by the Bible if we're a group of folks where sinners aren't welcome. We started several weeks ago a look at what we're calling 2020 vision, kind of a look at where the church is going in 2020 and the roaring 20s, those years beyond. Kind of a look at, if you don't know where you're going, how are you going to know when you're there? And so, you know, when you're on a trip, you look at your GPS for a couple of reasons. Number one, so you'll know where you're going. But really, most of the time, you know where you're going. You look at your GPS to know how long it is until you get there, right? And so that's kind of what we're doing. We're using as our GPS our mission, our vision statement, which goes like this. And we know this. It's on the slideshow that we show every Sunday morning. It's on the wall in our family room. It's on our website, several different places. It goes like this. To live as God's family under the cross, loving, serving, praising, and protecting, and proclaiming. And so we've looked at what it means to live as God's family, and we've talked about that. We've looked at what it means to live under the cross, and we've talked about that. And so now we're starting to look at the things that toward the end, what it means to live as God's family under the cross, loving. So that's what we're looking at this morning. When I was in graduate school, my major professor loved debate. He was known as a debater, and that's the way that he taught a lot of his classes. I don't remember ever writing a term paper in his class. In fact, I don't think he never assigned term papers. What he assigned was writing debate notebooks. Every class, we had to prepare a debate notebook. And part of that was not just preparing the debate notebook, you had to debate him in class. That was one of the major grades in his classes. And the more silly he made you look in class, the lower your grade was. And he could really make people look silly. In fact, I remember some guys literally having tears in their eyes. He had them so turned around. I was kind of on to him. I sort of knew how to kind of respond to him. And so I usually did fairly well. Not that I'm bragging or anything. I learned a lot in Dr. Warren's class. One of the things I learned was not what he wanted me to learn. What I learned was that debate is not very helpful. What debate teaches you is how to argue. It doesn't teach you anything about what the truth is. It teaches you who's better at arguing. I mean, every day in class, once we got to that part of the semester, he would convince us to be atheists or Mormons, depending on what we were talking about. It wasn't about the truth. It was about how good he was at arguing. Now, did Jesus ever argue and make people look silly? Yeah, but you got to think about what it was who it was that he was arguing with. It wasn't about people who were searching for truth. Jesus was very gentle with those people. He would patiently teach them I mean, he would tell them stories and teach them in parables. In fact, those were the guys that Jesus would sit down and have lunch with. No, the people that Jesus would debate with were the good church folks, the people that thought they had all the answers, the people that were constantly challenging him. They were challenging him because he was challenging all of their traditions. He wasn't following all of their pat answers. But in a large degree, they were always challenging Jesus, and he was constantly debating them because of the people that Jesus hung out with. They did not approve who it was that Jesus did accept. And we see that over and over again. In Luke chapter 5 and verse 30, "But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law who belonged to their sect," that is the sect of the Pharisees, "complained to the disciples, 'Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?'" This was after Jesus called Matthew Levi to be his apostle. Jesus is walking along and he sees Matthew sitting at his tax table, and he said, "Hey, you come and follow me." And afterwards, in appreciation, Matthew Levi threw a big party for him, and Jesus went and ate with all of Matthew's tax collector friends. And the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were flabbergasted that Jesus would hang out with those kinds of people. And then a couple of chapters later, in Luke chapter 7, the Pharisee who had invited him to a dinner said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." This is a sinful woman who's anointing his feet and wiping it with his hair, with her hair. Oh, if he was a prophet, he would know that she's a sinful woman. Jesus goes to a lot of trouble to defend her. This is who he's there to call, Jesus explains. And then, of course, setting up what several parables, including the parable of the prodigal son. Now, the tax collectors and the sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered. I love that word, muttered. "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." You see, this was the kind of people that Jesus accepted. This is the ones that the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, the good religious people could not accept that Jesus accepted. You see, they saw holiness as they maintained it by who they excluded. They were sort of like leprosy, kind of like I am this morning. I'm not shaking hands with people because I don't want you to get my cold. They didn't want to get people's sin on them, so sin was kind of like cooties. You stay away from people that have it. So they weren't going to get near to anybody that had sin, and they couldn't understand why it was that Jesus was getting up close and personal with all of these sinful people. And Jesus was constantly trying to explain to them, "These are the people that I've come to minister to. I've come to seek and to save those that are lost." But you see, kind of hidden in that they didn't really understand, oh, by the way, that group includes you as well. And you should be seeking me just as I am seeking and trying to save them. They didn't understand. In fact, they never did. Jesus had the reputation of being one that sought after sinners. He was a safe place for sinners to be. They wanted to be around him. And if we're going to be the church of Christ, then we need to have the reputation of being one that receives sinners. We are to be known not by who we exclude, but by who we accept. So, what kind of reputation do we have with those on the outside? How do outsiders see us? I mean, we really know the answer to that before we kind of look at it, but just ask that for, think about that for a second. How do people that are what we would call unchurched, those who are out in the culture, how do they see church folks? Well, about 9 or 10 years ago, Dave Kinneman, who works with Barna Research, wrote a book called Unchristian, where he kind of did some research and did some surveys and some research with particularly younger unchurched people and tried to determine how it is that people with no church upbringing and no church background, how they see church people. And here's what he came up with. When asked how do unchurched people view Christians, the number one thing they said, oh, Christians, they're the one that hate gay people. That's the number one answer. Number two, oh, they're all hypocrites. Number three, they're too political. It's almost, with a lot of unchurched people, they equate the church with the GOP. And fourth, judgmental. Those are the four first things that non-Christian, non-churched people equate Christian people with. Are we happy, satisfied, comfortable with that? Well, of course we're not. A lot of that, of course, comes from the way that Christian people are presented in the media. But, you know, we've come by a lot of that the old-fashioned way. We've earned it. I think we have to agree, at least we should agree, that this is not the reputation that we should have. In fact, Jesus tells us what the reputation that we should have to the world. In John 13 and verse 34, a new command I give you, love one another as I have loved you. So you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. Jesus says that the way the world will know that you're following me is the love that you have for one another. That's the reputation that Jesus wants us to have. Oh, Christian people, they're those folks that love one another so much. That's the reputation he wants us to have with the world. Those are the folks that are following Jesus. They love like he loves. Now, how can that be a new commandment? He says, this is a new commandment I'm giving to you. Now remember, this is how Jesus is preparing the apostles right before his crucifixion. He says, okay, a new commandment I'm giving. This is in the context of him washing the disciples' feet, and the example of him washing their feet, and I'm giving you this new commandment. How is that new? Well, suppose I tell you, okay, I just bought a new car. What would you think? Well, you might think that you're paying me way too much. But besides that, what might you think? Well, a new car might mean that I went down to the dealership and bought a 2020 brand new off the showroom car. But you might think, no, I probably didn't do that. Probably what I did is I went over to Tony and he hooked me up with a brand new 2010 something or other. It's new to me car. That would be a new car, right? But a new car might mean that it sucks water vapor out of the air and burns the hydrogen for fuel. That would be a brand new, one-of-a-kind car. Something totally different that's never been seen before. See, that's what Jesus meant when he said a new command. This is a command that's never been seen before. You see, when he says, it's the love one another part. When Jesus was asked, what's the greatest command of the Old Testament? He said, love the Lord with all of your heart, right? And love your neighbor as yourself. Love had been seen in the Old Testament. But here he says, love one another as I have loved you, right? You see, when they talked about love, here's the way they were taught love. In Matthew 5, in the Sermon on the Mount, you have heard it was said, this is what they've been taught by the rabbis, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. That's the love they've been taught. Yeah, you're to love people, but only as far as they're lovable. But Jesus says, here's the love I'm teaching you, to love others as I have loved you. My command, this is later in John 15, my command is this, love others as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. Jesus laid down his life, not just for his friends, but for all of us. Jesus said, that's how I want you to love. Love everyone so much that you're willing to lay down your life for people. Whoa, that's a love that's beyond anything we've ever seen before. Later on in in 1 John 4, John explains this love as completing the love that God has for us. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us, and His love is made complete in us. That it's like we complete the love that God has for us when we're able to spread that love out to other folks. That we complete the love of God. Later on, he's going to say, same context, he's going to say, listen, folks, if you don't love each other, whom you can see, how can you even say that you love other folks? Or how can you say that you love God, whom you can't see? How can you say, he's going to also say, if you see your brother and sister in need, and you don't help them, how can the love of God be in you? See, this love of God thing is concrete and real, and you really complete the love of God when you extend it to other people. 1 Thessalonians 3 and verse 12, Paul writes, may the Lord make your love increase and overflow for each other and for everyone else. You see, this love that we're to have for each other is to go, we're not to keep it inside the church. We're to allow it to overflow to other people as well. Just as he says, as ours does for you. We're to be known as the people that love other folks. We're to be known by the love of Christ. That's how the church is supposed to be known. Not as the people that can out-debate other folks. Not as folks who can get in a fight at the drop of a hat. But as the folks who love as Christ loved. Well, what's the point for this 2020 vision for Denby? Well, it's not that we somehow need to soft-pedal the truth or downplay the Bible. I'm not suggesting that we avoid certain things so certain issues don't come up so other people will like us. The point isn't that we don't become open-minded to the point that our brains fall out. We have to speak the truth in love. We can't do that unless we have that love. I cringe every time somebody starts out by saying, well, brother, I'm just speaking the truth in love here, but because almost every time what follows is not going to be very loving. Sometimes speaking the truth in love is just an excuse to be extremely unloving. It's like truth is like an excuse for being pretty ugly. We cannot speak the truth in love unless we're going to be loving. You see, one of the things the Bible teaches, one of the truths that the Bible does not back up on, is love one another. Years ago, I preached a sermon on hell. I remember somebody saying afterward, I don't know why this sermon sticks in my mind, but it does. One person said, boy, that's about as close to hellfire and damnation as you get, isn't it? Yeah, it was. But I remember this. And it was a long time ago. I mean, it was a long time ago. It was a Sunday night sermon. That was a long time. We haven't had Sunday night sermons in a long time. But somebody came rushing up to me after it was over and said, I really enjoyed that. You really enjoyed that sermon on hell? I must not have done a very good job if somebody enjoyed a sermon on hell. And then they went on to say, yeah, I just get so tired of all those love sermons. I wanted to say, well, you need to take that up with the management. You know, Jesus didn't say, the greatest commandment is on hell. No, he didn't say that. You know, he said the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is likened to it, love your neighbor as yourself. That's what he said. And Paul didn't say that the greatest of these is hell. No, he didn't say that. He said the greatest of these is love. So take it up with management that the Bible talks about love being so important. That we are commanded that we are to love one another. Of course, love doesn't mean that we can turn a blind eye to sin. So, does that mean that we are supposed to love the sinner and hate the sin? Now, that statement is usually attributed to Gandhi, but actually it goes back to Augustine, who said it in the 400s. Actually, what he said, that we are to love what God loves, people, and we are to hate what God hates, sin. And while that is technically true, we don't usually apply it very consistently or very lovingly. Do we really hate what God hates, or do we just hate some of the sins of some of the people? When Christians stand against sin, why is it so often just the sins out there rather than our own sin or the sins of the church? Many churches have taken very vocal stands against homosexual marriage. Christian bakers have refused to bake wedding cakes for gay marriages. But why haven't we taken stands against greed and pride and lust and envy and gluttony and all of the seven deadly sins? Because they hit too close to home, perhaps? I just read of a report in the Houston Chronicle that came out earlier this year on sex abuse in the Southern Baptist Convention. That report uncovered 380 church leaders and over 700 abuse victims in the Houston area, sexual abuse in the Southern Baptist Church. Why has no one refused to bake a cake for someone in the Southern Baptist Church? You see, we're very selective about our outrage because of sin. It seems that when we hate the sin, it's only some sins of some sinners. Why don't we listen to what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 9? I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people. Not at all meaning the people of this world who are immoral or greedy or swindlers or idolaters. In that case, you would have to leave the world. He goes on in verse 12, what business is it of mine to judge those outside the church? Are you not to judge those inside? Paul is telling us, yes, we're to have outrage. Yes, we are to judge sin. But our own. Not the sin of the culture. Not the sin of the world. Am I loving the sinner if I make no effort to build a relationship with them? Granted, I'm not loving the sinner if I let somebody continue on their way to hell. But how do I let them know? Do I stop people on the street and point my finger at them and say, sinner! They're not going to listen. And that's the point. The only way that I'm going to get people to listen to me is to build relationships. And that's what the church is supposed to do. That's what the church is for. To build relationships with people so that we can point Christ to them. And as Art said this morning, to show them the blood of Christ, which is the only power to wash away sins. But we can't do that from long distance. The only way we can do that is by building relationships up close and personal. Like Jesus did, across the table, up close and personal. I started today by using the example of homosexuality. Let me close with another example. There are three positions, basically. There are probably variations of each of these, of positions that churches take on the issue of homosexuality. The first is usually called affirming. This position is that some churches take that homosexuality is basically a right position, that monogamous homosexual positions should be affirmed, and some churches do that. Others, for lack of a better term, are non-affirming. They believe that homosexuality is wrong in every form or format, and there should be condemned or not affirmed. But there's a third position, and that is most often called accepting. That while homosexuality is wrong and sinful, that it's just a sin like any other, and that sinners should be accepted, that the best place for sinners is in the church, so that they can learn the gospel, so that they can see Jesus, so they can experience Christ. And so while we should not affirm sin, that we should accept every sinner. My vision for the Church of Denby is that we should be accepting, not just of homosexual people, but for all sinful people. That the church be a safe place for all sinners. Let me end this morning with a story that I shared very briefly Wednesday night. It's a story that I think I stole from Preston Sprinkle. I think that's where I got it, in one of his books. He tells of a lesbian couple that came to start attending an accepting church. He says that for whatever reason, they made a relationship with the people of this church. They knew the church believed that homosexuality was wrong, but they made friends, and they were valued by the church. There was no subterfuge. Everybody knew how everybody felt, but they were allowed to come. They were allowed to get involved. That every time the topic came up, the preacher taught exactly what the Bible taught, and they were fine with that. In fact, surveys indicate that gay people are willing to go to churches that believe that that homosexuality is wrong, as long as they're accepted. After 20 years, this married lesbian couple repudiated their lifestyle, became celibate, even though still together, and gave their life fully to Christ. What would have happened had the line been drawn in the sand after 3 visits? Maybe the whole point of love the sinner and hate the sin is that we should just stop with love. Just love and point people to Christ. John says that it's the work of the Holy Spirit to convict people of sin. That it is the work of God to judge. Maybe we should just be the people who love. Let's pray together.